Right, so first of all, thanks, Stephen, other organizers for having this talk. Having had two very nice top-down talk approaches in the morning and this nice overview from Rachmaninoff just before of the superluminous, I will not have much time to talk about the pairing stabilities. I actually won't. It's not in the plan, but feel free to ask questions about that at the end. The task here is, how does one get information? This is sort of the opposite approach, it's a bottom-up approach. You look at the data, try and extract information, match it to models. And the general area, as has been mentioned, 1BC superluminous, they should be classified as 1BCs if you go by standard supernova classification. So put them all in the same bin and see what one can do. The classical sort of semi-established classification of these things is 1Bs have some hydrogen, 2Bs have some hydrogen, 1Bs are dominated by some helium lines, and then the 1Cs that have neither hydrogen nor helium go from narrow lines to broad lines. And there's a number of questions one has to ask, and they have been asked all the time. Hydrogen and helium in 1Bs and 2Bs, that's an atomic physics radiation transport problem, and the other thing is the width of the lines in 1Cs. I've always been fairly unhappy about drawing lines between what is narrow and what is not. It's very subjective. If you look at what has been classified as broad lines, sometimes you sort of feel that it's only being used just to attract attention. So, you know, same sort of observer's bias. A quick overview of what these things should be coming from. I don't want to spend much time on that, but you've got a strip of star of its outer layers to see either a small hydrogen shell or none of it. And then the helium, is it there, is it not there? And down here is a kind of stars that one would tentatively associate with the direct progenitor of what these are. And that's another talk and probably not one for me to give. So what we've done is to lay our hands on just about everything that was available and accessible in the way of stripped envelope supernovae. We're not looking at the superluminous here. There's one that just sort of straddles onto that. We'll get to that in a minute, I mean, towards the end of the talk. And this is from a paper that my student Simon Prentice put out last year. These two plots are the 1Bs and 2Bs, and the classification is from Circulus, Atil's papers. And here is the 1Cs with the broad lined, including the GAB supernovae in red. And you can see that there's an offset in mean luminosity between the 1Cs and the rest. And there's some confusion within those two groups. And I've not divided them that way accidentally. It's very deliberate, in fact. So one can go back to this, unfortunately, fuzzy plot, because when you expand it, it loses resolution from Wei Dong's paper based on Kite data in 2011. He didn't have that many supernovae, but he came up with his pie charts. And if you actually do the maths, these are the internal rates of 2Bs, 1Bs, and 1Cs among supernovae, so dominated by the 1Cs in his example, and then with a lot more 2Bs than 1Bs, which is interesting. And it calls for the question, are there continua, as we heard before, in luminosity, but here also in things like distribution of hydrogen line strength. So what we've done is looked at every one of those supernovae. They had this many of spectral coverage, so we're down to about 50, which is probably bigger than other samples. Not as big as we would like, but reasonably big. And what we find is that we can actually see a range of hydrogen line strength until we get to a point where the line is confused with a silicon line, and velocity arguments tell us it's probably a silicon line. So we sort of would like to reclassify this range of 2Bs, 1Bs into these four classes. You can get more specific if you had more data. There's the clear 2Bs, there's the clear 1Bs, and there's things where hydrogen is there to different degrees of strength. So when you do that, you end up with slightly different distributions. We'll show you that later. The other question has been asked already a couple of times today is the presence or absence of helium. One way to answer this is to look further into the infrared where these two strongest helium lines occur. The 1 micron line is notoriously blended with several other lines. it may not be the place, the best place to look, but if you look at 2 microns, you've got sort of the same system line in reasonably good isolation. If you go into the infrared, the 1B example you've got here is the only supernova where you actually see something. In all the others that are classified as 1C optically or as a 1A down here, the 2 micron line is not there. Does that got any meaning? You can put this through a calculation where you try to simulate the non-thermal spectrum of nickel and cobalt decay and creation of fast particles from the radioactive decays themselves, and you end up with this little figure that my students Stefan Hackinger at the time came up with, showing that as soon as you add order of a tenth of the solar mass of helium on something that doesn't have a lot of nickel 56, so the nickel 56 mass here was about 0.1, you start seeing the helium lines. Okay. Same is true for the hydrogen. Once you add about a tenth of the solar mass of hydrogen, then you see the hydrogen lines, and that matches different observed supernovae. So we can sort of put boundaries as to how much hydrogen one needs and how much helium one needs. If the nickel 56 mass was larger, then the helium mass in particular would be lower. The minimum mass of sea helium would actually be lower. And there's not a lot of mixing. We haven't had to sort of put the nickel out into the helium. You just have to wait for the diffusion to work so you can excite these lines, which is one reason why 1Bs become 1Bs, not at the beginning, but a bit later on. So that should explain that. We switch to the 1Cs. And the question here is, what do broad lines mean? I mean, they do mean energy. How do they actually mean energy? To have a broad line, you need material at high velocity, you need mass, and V squared gives you a higher energy. As I said, I've been unhappy with distinguishing between broad lines and everything else, and actually what we've done is taken a few examples and simply counted lines in the sort of general optical range that most people will cover with their data, and the number given here is the number of lines that we count, and we can spend a different session deciding what these lines are and so on, but names of supernovae are associated here. So the G of E supernovae are fewer lines because I got more material at high velocity. And the fact that that happens and that the general velocity increases as the number of lines decreases tells you that the kinetic energy grows with mass to some power, which is slightly larger than one. Okay? So I prefer to call them this way at this point because it's a clearer classification of what you're looking at. And some of these, some people would have called broad lined. So I would say, well, you've got to be clear about what you do. So the reclassification exercise we've done, I've talked about 1Bs and 2Bs, 1Bs showing hydrogen, no 1Cs has showed helium in what we've done, there's about 50 supernovae here, as I said. So we started with this from the literature, we end up there. And the interesting thing here is what you do with these. If you say, well, there's hydrogen here, then these become hydrogen rich, and the number of 1Bs that are pure 1Bs becomes quite small. So you either have some hydrogen left or you have nothing. No hydrogen, no helium, by and large, with some exceptions. So that's an interesting result, I think. And that's what the distribution by properties looks like, where the 1Cs have been divided by this line number thing, and the colors here are where they came from. And the 1Bs and 2Bs here are divided equally, but if you classify these as having some hydrogen, then the hydrogen-rich stripped envelope far dominate this group. Okay? And you're at 40%, 14%, which is actually very, very close to Wei Dong's numbers 5-6 years ago, which is interesting. So blending of lines. Now I said high velocities, more blending, fewer lines. That is the story that we've learned. What lines are visible? If you try and model these spectra, you will see the optical depths overlap. So at some point, the calcium lines becomes very fast because it's a high velocity, high GF value line, so it's a very sensitive line. So you blend it with the oxygen line. So when you measure this, you're not quite sure what you're seeing once it's blended. Same is true here for a bunch of lines, including lots of iron lines. Point being, what you measure may very much depend on what you decide to measure. But that isn't the only way things happen. There's this interesting set of three supernovae where the spectra don't really change much, but they just shift towards higher velocities. So if you count number of lines or use line width, or whatever you like to use to define that, they will be similar, but they will be at higher velocities, which will violate the idea that higher velocities give you broader lines. So you've got two ways of broadening spectra or making them higher velocity. So clearly there are two parameters that can vary either independently or not. So if you go to fewer features, you're increasing the ratio of energy over mass. But if you just shift the spectra, you're probably just increasing the mass and not changing the ratio of energy and mass. So you're creating an opacity further out, you get the same spectrum with the same number of lines, but more mass underneath that spectrum. Okay, so here you're not increasing the specific energy of the explosion, while there you do. And both of these are possible. You can actually make lines broader or just shift spectra. And we obviously need more data to cover more of these properties, because 50 is not nearly enough. Sorry for the quality of this, but we try to reproduce this with very simple simulated spectra. What does line width actually mean? It means more than energy itself, it means density slope in the outermost layers. So these totally artificial models play with the density slope in the outer bit. They're not physically realistic. The only one that is the result of a calculation of explosion is the purple line there. We just added flatter densities to the outside just to see what that would do. That would, of course, increase the kinetic energy without hardly changing the mass. And just as a note, remember that the width of the light curve and the measurement of the velocity is used in many, many papers to claim to define the mass and the energy to a certain number of decimal places, which is very nice, but also very risky, because you have to know what you're measuring. You measure one velocity, but at what time do you measure it? And you can read on. So what line is it you're measuring? Are you getting all the kinetic energy by measuring a peak? Since time elapses between explosion and peak, and the highest velocity material may no longer be optically thick. So you may be missing absorption that tells you about mass at high velocity and therefore tells you about energy. So taking those few model densities, plot is nicely invisible, so you can just believe my words. I tried a white background, it's just as bad. I ran out of colors. So these spectra are all the same if you compute them at peak, 15 days. But if you go to about a week after explosion, which is rarely observed, then they differ in line width because you've got more absorption at high velocity when the density is flatter outside. So there's an interesting relation between the density profile of the outer layers and the number of lines you measure early on. So that tells you your velocity estimate based on maximum light determination can be highly uncertain. And that is strengthened by the fact that velocities observed, or actually these are model velocities for some of the models we've produced, change dramatically over time. In some cases, they decline over more than a factor of two or three between first observations we can get and sort of maximum light, which for these is between 10 and about 15 days, depending on the supernova. The one I want to highlight here is the most recent example of a GRB supernova, 16JCA, where we managed to get early spectra, easily really reacted properly this time, so we got spectra of it about less than four days after the GRB. At that time, we could actually start seeing supernova lines. We got earlier spectra than that where no lines are visible yet, but we measured line velocities, photospheric positions actually, velocities are much higher than that, of larger than 40,000 kilometers per second. And then these velocities drop dramatically, right? So we can fit that with one of our usual models. You've seen many examples of those in talks before. Comparison between JCA thing and 90ABW shows you very similar spectra, but depressed in the UV, or the near UV in the blue. Which tells us there's a larger metal content because that is where metal absorptions are strongest. So we fit a tiny series of spectra here with a model that is fairly similar to the standard GMB supernova model, and end up with a situation like this. Ellen was able to determine from the X-ray and light curves in the optical quite wide opening angle of the jet, about 20 degrees. So we're not looking at a pencil beam jet. We're looking at something with significant opening angle. And then there's a nuclearly processed region that leads to nickel dominating the abundances at the earliest spectra, where we see sort of this section of the exploding thing. And the shape here is completely arbitrary. I have not tried. We have no idea how aspherical this will be, but it probably is, if you want to preserve energies. And then as we go deeper, as time goes on, we see more of the lateral oxygen-rich region, and we see oxygen abundances increasing with depth, which is not what you would expect. But we've actually seen this now, not just with the nebula spectra, as we had before, but even with the early time data. So that's an interesting observation that was only possible because we got easier to react quickly, and probably because we were really looking down the throat of this thing. Mm-hmm. So you may have seen this diagram before, correlating energies and masses. Nothing special about this GMB supernova. It's just caught early, it's got nice data, but it falls exactly what all the other ones do. High energies, large ejected mass, fairly large nickel 56 mass. And I will still believe that nickel 56 drives these because of all the late time evidence we have for ion emission lines. The superluminous supernova is a different thing. I've not added it to this plot where we are showing that the supernovae carry most of the energy work we did with Ellen and Stan and Andrew McFadyen a few years ago. But this falls basically where 13CQ, I think, is, and I can say more about that. Again, the GMB seems energetic, but once you correct it and compare it to the supernova energy, the supernova dominates in kinetic energy output, while the radio is a decent proxy for the relativistic emission, because the bisector is kind of doing a good job between the gamma ray energy and the radio energy. We heard about this magneta in 05BF. It's one of the ways to explain the second bump to a light curve that peaked there and then continued on here. So this would be a nickel light curve, and this we at the time interpreted as a late magneta injection. Why am I mentioning this? Because if you go back to the plot before, the apparent constancy of the energy of the supernovae may suggest that there is something with the standard energy that you're using to make these events. And that energy is similar to the maximum energy you can get out of a magneta. So there is a suggestion there that magnetas may be powering these explosions, giving them the energy, and possibly contributing to the nucleosynthesis, as we had done in the case of 06BF, 06AJ, sorry. So in the last couple of minutes, just a quick comment about spectra of superluminous supernovae and how one can get them without doing too much work, in a sense. So you have a high luminosity, and you've got these very highly excited lines. The trick is sort of similar to what happens with type 1Bs. The oxygen lines are very highly excited, and they don't come up in a thermal model because the temperature you need is very high. And I'll show that in the next slide. But what I want to emphasize is that the same supernova, if you wait long enough, develops helium-1 lines. Why are they not there here? Because most of the helium is actually helium-2. So you don't expect to see them now, but if you follow them, if you follow the supernovae long enough, not all of them, but some do show helium-1 lines. So paradoxically, they're too hot here, and that's the right temperature regime. But Ragnar showed us how much brighter these are than normal 1Bs and 1Cs, so you've got a lot more energy there. So you're obviously in a higher state energetically than you would be in a normal 1B, 1C. Well, I've shown you the helium-1 atom. This is the oxygen-2 atom. And these are the lines that we see early on in superluminous type 1, not all of them. So you can see the excitation levels of these lines are 20 electron volts, which is higher than what you need for the helium-1 lines. So you need to excite those lines. Then you'll leave an imprint on the optical spectrum. It'll be very difficult to do this thermally, because you'll need much higher temperatures than what we see in the supernovae. So the same treatment that allows us to do the helium-1 allows us to do the oxygen-2, and Dan's very correct in saying it'd be nice to have a top-down calculation of what the X-ray spectrum looks like and can it actually be deposited in this layer and cause these lines. But basically we're looking at a carbon-oxygen core with sometimes some helium on top. The last thing I want to mention, because I'm not sure it's been mentioned already, is this was the brightest supernova in our sample before, which we still call a 1BC, 1C actually. It came with an ultra-long gamma-ray burst, so something that went on for about 10,000 seconds. And the spectrum looked like this, fairly featureless. It is actually not that hard to produce that spectrum if you take the same general input we used to compute the spectra of AJG and just give it more energy so the lines spread out. And because they blend so effectively, they basically just disappear and you're left with just very, very few features that match this admittedly very noisy spectrum. So the supernova is in between the range of superluminous luminosities and the range of, this is a GAB supernova, it's right in between, so it may be some of the things that Ragnar was talking about. It'd be really interesting to see what others look like, but this came with an ultra-long gamma-ray burst. There's only about four of those known, and this is the only case where we actually have a spectrum of the supernova. So that's an interesting area. Talk about rare things. No idea how rare these are, but must be extremely rare. One thing you can do to tell 1Cs from superluminous supernovae is look at the velocity evolution. I think this sort of will fall out of what Dan was saying earlier, because once you run a shock, make the density flat, you expect in these sharp regions where the densities are steep for velocities to stall over time. And this is kind of like what we see in a superluminous supernova. We don't see that in a GAB supernova. Okay. So that's one way that one can infer differences between what the density structures look like. And I think the behavior of, in particular, AJG here is very suggestive of the kind of magnetar powering mechanism that Dan was showing earlier. So just comparing general properties from all these studies and stuff I've not been able to talk about, the distinction between 1C's broad line and GAB supernovae is essentially the ratio of energy over mass, where the masses range from 1, roughly, to order 10. If you want to go to the superluminous regime, E over M value doesn't change very much. The superluminous supernovae have E over M of about 1, but very large masses, and the high luminosity causes the spectra. The one supernova with ultra-long GAB has a slightly larger value of the ratio of energy over mass, but it does not have a particularly large mass, as far as we could determine. Read the rest. And I'll end with this, which is a sort of Metzger-style plot of the kind of magnetar parameters you need to fit the various things that I've described. Or I'm not just trying to make a Likert fit here, because I'm claiming that many of these have Likerts powered by nickel. One is just trying to see what would give you the energy at the right time and what would impart enough kinetic energy to the supernova ejector to see what we see. And I'll stop at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we have time for some questions. There's one by Steve.
Paolo, for the oxygen 2 line, so for the well-sampled superluminous supernova around peak, the oxygen 2 lines seem to persist from pre-peak to peak, but then just afterwards they seem to disappear and the spectra become featureless. If they're non-thermally excited, is there a reason why that non-thermal excitation turns off and pretty much
if
at the same time?
If they came from nickel, there wouldn't be a reason, because you probably will still have fast particles coming through. So it may just be something else that is powering these. The densities at which these lines form may be dropping. That may be a reason why the interaction is less effective. But I certainly will be interested to do a proper calculation of what the X-ray spectrum would be like of interaction of magnetar engine with the inside of the ejector. There's also the general cooling of the spectrum, which reduces in favors lower temperatures.
So. Dan Kaysen.
You said there was evidence for helium in some of the superluminous. Yes. Is it? Can you constrain where and how much helium? If I remember, the helium you sort of mixed in with the oxygen, but it be layered, or is it a...
It's basically at the same place as the oxygen, maybe slightly higher velocities, but on average the same place. We've not, since we don't have the X-ray input model, we've not done a quantity.
So you can't constrain how much helium...
Not how much until we've got proper X-ray spectrum, clearly, right? Okay. So we have the target, but we don't have the...
Okay, so yesterday, if I understood right, Mariam said that the rate of 1Bs relative to 1Cs was about 2 to 1. Today it sounded like you're saying it's more like 1 to 4. So what's going on? I'm confused.
I have no answer for that.
Okay.
I can only say we looked at 50-odd spectra, and that's what we came up with.
These objects often...
No. We looked at data where we had time evolution of spectra. We look at different epochs. Can we see helium lines? Do we see hydrogen lines? It may be a difference in sample size. So way down sample was significantly smaller than this. I know of a couple, there's a paper on the archive by Isaac Shivers, I think, where he reclassifies, he claims big changes in the rates by reclassifying two. Obviously, if we reclassify two, nothing would change. I think this is one for sitting together and looking at our data.
Stan has a question.
The supernova GRB with the iron jet, were you able to get onto that earlier than usual because the afterglow was faint or something? Or would you expect to see this in all GRBs if you saw them soon enough at the right angle?
I would have thought it should be a fairly common behavior. We were, as I said, lucky to be able to get onto it early. The afterglow was not particularly strong, but earlier we don't see lines, so we may see more afterglow than supernova. A BW core earlier may be even an even better example, but then in this case I think we're also lucky in being more on axis, I think, than we would have been in 98 BW. But yeah, it's a matter of trying.
More questions? If there are no more questions, we thank Paolo. And